This podcast features graphic details of real events taken from letters written by inmates convicted of murder. Listener discretion is advised.
During the time of taking his life, I felt nothing for him. He was a piece of shit who preyed on women and did things he thought he had a right to do.
These are the written words of Texas death row inmate 999523, Richard Tabler.
I have asked Jesus Christ to forgive me these cowardly acts that I did back then, and to give me a clean slate. And he has.
They're taken from letters that he wrote to us in 2017. My name is Zoe Hines, and Richard Tabler is one of over 2,000 inmates that my colleague Ned Parker and I have corresponded with in our work as documentary producers investigating violent crime and the lives of those who enact it.
This is Letters from a Killer, a Podimo podcast. Episode 15, False Prophet.
Most of us think of ourselves as pretty good people, but this goodness is both self-adjudicated, based on criteria we ourselves set, and relative to the behaviour of others. This episode's letter writer makes it clear he also considers himself comparatively good, in the context of the criminal underworld he inhabits. And he asks us, as readers, to reconsider our moral boundaries with that particular world in mind. In his letters, Tabler asks us to imagine that the taking of multiple innocent lives was actually the lesser of evils. But does the very fact that this writer tries to frame himself as someone who killed out of goodness suggest he's warped the story? Is this just an inmate trying to spin his awful crimes to make them more palatable? And in the process, trying to avoid confronting who he really is?
Richard Tabler goes further than any other inmate whose letters we've read in terms of trying to connect directly with the person writing to him. But before we hear how he goes about this, we should first get to know the details of his crime. Please be warned that this case file contains details that some listeners may find disturbing.
Letters from a Killer. Case File. The following details are taken from official news reports and court documents. November 2004. After a row with his boss, Muhammad Amin Rahmouni, Richard Tabler acquired a pickup truck, a camcorder, and a 9mm gun. The next evening, on Thanksgiving, Tabler called Rahmouni under the pretense of selling him stereo equipment. They arranged to meet in the car park of a local business. At around 2 a.m. on the morning of Friday the 26th of November, Rahmouni was driven to the car park by a friend called Zayed. Richard Tabler, along with an accomplice, was waiting for them. As soon as they saw Zayed's car pull up, Tabler fired through their open windows, hitting both men. Tabler exited his truck and pulled both men from the car. Seeing that Rahmouni was still alive, he had his accomplice video record him while his victim begged for his life. Tabler then executed Rahmouni. This video evidence was apparently destroyed by Tabler after showing the footage to a friend. 2 days later, Tabler was arrested. He confessed to the murder the following day.
Richard Tabler explains that Muhammad Amin Rahmouni was his boss, and in his letters to us, he refers to him simply as Amin. We discover in this story that Amin was allegedly involved in certain illicit activities, which revolved around the location of a strip club that he owned, called Teasers with a Z.
In his first letter to us, Tabler tells us about an incident that had occurred sometime before, but which seems to form the motivation for this attack on Amin and his colleague.
What started all this shit between us was some major illegal activities that had caused me to drive with a friend of Amin's in his truck to San Antonio a month before.
On the night of the incident, Amin allegedly had his friend Mo force Tabler to deliver a girl to him at a lake. From the way Tabler writes about this, we assume that this girl was one of the dancers from the Teasers strip club.
Tabler describes what apparently happened next.
We were a little after 3 in the morning, driving down the freeway. And this fool pointed a gun in my face, telling me in unspoken words that they were going to kill the girl and were willing to kill me. Mo pulled his gun and pointed it at my head and told me I was driving to the lake. Not really thinking about it, I put my seatbelt on and softly told the girl to place hers on. Before Mo had a chance to do anything, I had the truck screaming down the freeway at 100 plus miles per hour and headed for the divider on the off-ramp. Mo is screaming at me to stop the truck before I kill them. He's waving his gun, telling me to stop. Right at the last minute, I slam on the brakes, which causes Mo to throw his arms up on the dash, and in doing so, drop his gun, which slid over to my side. The rest is history. Mo did not return to Killeen, and the girl was dropped somewhere else.
This description, where he asks the girl to put the seatbelt on, and the general tone of his letter reads like it's been directly lifted out of a bad action movie starring Steven Seagal. Tabler is setting himself up as a kind of gangster with a heart of gold who works for an evil boss who was an abuser of women.
The way he finishes this passage by writing that the girl was dropped somewhere else positions this as some kind of rescue mission. He's the good guy in this evil underworld scenario.
And at the end of the extract, he also alludes to the fate of Mo. It feels as if he's insinuating that he's killed Mo, but he's deliberately keeping this teasing and vague, simply stating that Mo did not return to Killeen, kind of like something in the Wild West where they would drive the bad guy out of town. And it seems he's decided that Mo doesn't deserve any further focus, because this is all about him. It's all about Richard Tabler.
Despite this incident, it seems Tabler's working relationship with Amin continues. But as Tabler continues to write to us, he explains that at a later date, it did sour. And as we heard in the case file, this is the point where Tabler claims he called Amin and arranged to meet him under the pretense of selling him stereo equipment.
So back to the meeting with Amin and Frank and Timothy. Amin was my boss at Teasers, where I was working for him under the table. This means I was accepting payment from him for things that are illegal. He ran things like guns, drugs, weapons, and fake IDs. I'd been hearing around from those I worked with that Amin had been running around telling people he was going to kill me and that he knew where my mom and sister lived. When I called him on his cell, I didn't let on that I knew of these things.
Tabler describes what happened after he apparently lured Amin to the car park to sell him this equipment. Please be advised that the following clip contains graphic details that some listeners may find disturbing.
During the time of taking his life, I felt nothing for him. He was a piece of shit who preyed on women and did things he thought he had a right to do. Words were exchanged. Some threats were made by Frank, who was driving the car, and Amin was talking on his phone. When Frank turned his head to Amin, after threatening to kill my mom and sister, as he was turning back, he caught one gunshot through his head. Amin is screaming, "What the fuck? What the fuck?" Before he's able to scream it the third time, I shot him through his hand, holding the phone to his left ear, thus not getting a clean shot that would kill him. The phone caused the shot to slant a little, thus causing me to have to get out of the truck and walk around to the side of his car, which is where Timothy came around, holding the video camera and filming what was going on. I told Timothy to give me the camera and pull Amin out of the car, which he did. Once Amin was on the cold ground on his back, he started to talk to me, pointing up at the sky, at which time I placed the gun on his forehead and told him, "Who has the power now, Amin? Fuck you and Allah." And blew his brains out. I walked slowly back to the truck, got in, and drove away.
Tabler is just continuing to paint this picture of himself as a hero, as a protector of women. And interestingly now, he's also made what feels like a very deliberate reference to the fact that his victims were Muslim. It feels like a very consciously chosen descriptor. And as we will discover later in his letters, Tabler turns to Christianity when he's in prison. And so knowing that, I personally find him using this kind of language here pretty telling. It feels like, in addition to heroically saving women, he's now also framing himself as some kind of religious crusader.
And then there's Tabler's reference to the fact that this brutal incident was caught on camera. It gives the impression that Tabler somehow saw this as an event worthy of recognition, some kind of underworld power play or a warning to others. Or perhaps from Tabler's simplistic good versus bad perspective, this is just a record of wrong being put right, of vigilante justice being served. If so, this further dehumanises his victims. It makes them just bad guys to be dispensed of, as opposed to somebody's father, someone's brother, or their son.
The highly detailed use of language and information that Tabler is giving us is almost certainly in order to try to convince us, the reader, that he's somehow a better person, a more moral person, a more justified person than the case file would have painted him, or the details of the court case would have described these events. So what is his motivation for doing that? Either it's simply because this is the truth and he's just being honest about how he remembers it, or are we dealing here with somebody who cares very deeply about what people, including us, the readers of these letters, might think of him?
This is Letters from a Killer, a Podimo podcast.
We're going to pause our episode of Letters from a Killer for a minute to tell you about our sponsor. The past months have reminded us to prepare for the unexpected. So get ready for when you need to pull an outfit together that doesn't include sweatpants. With Stitch Fix, you can get back to the new normal with your best style ever.
I went to stitchfix.co.uk/letters to set up my profile, and a stylist sent me outfits that were personalised to me. I chose the colours, styles and budget.
You pay a £10 styling fee for each fix, which is credited towards anything you keep. Schedule at any time, there's no subscription required. Plus shipping, returns and exchanges are easy and free.
You can even preview selections and be sure to get exactly your style, or let Stitch Fix do the hard work for you and send you surprises. It's basically like having your own personal stylist. Get started today at stitchfix.co.uk/letters and you'll get 20% off when you keep everything in your fix.
That's stitchfix.co.uk/letters for 20% off when you keep everything in your fix. stitchfix.co.uk/letters.
This is Letters from a Killer, a Podimo podcast.
We've previously heard from Tabler about how he killed Amin and Frank, otherwise known as Zayed. Now let's return to his letters and hear more about how he describes the aftermath of this crime.
A couple of days after the fact, I started to have regrets. Not about how I killed him and Frank, but how I just left their bodies out there to be found. I could have gotten rid of them like Mo. Then one day, I was at my sister's house watching the news, and they were talking about the shooting. They were saying they had nothing and no suspects, at which time, my sister saw me watching the news. She saw the look on my face and put two and two together and looked at me in shock. I turned myself in to the authorities that night and confessed. After everything was done, I just shut myself off inside. I didn't think nor feel anything. Shit happens. I made my bed, and now I'll lay in it.
So here Tabler clarifies his earlier insinuation that he killed Mo, along with Amin and Frank, when he writes that he had gotten rid of Mo's body.
And I think what's notable here is the way that he begins this passage, in what is just a strikingly cold-hearted way, saying simply that he doesn't regret these killings. In Tabler's morally simplistic version of events where bad men got what they deserved, he seemingly can't regret killing these men because he was apparently justified in doing what he did. But life doesn't work like that. Justice doesn't work like that.
It's also notable to me that he wrote earlier about having quite a positive childhood with his sister and his mother, and we haven't heard anything more about his family since. But now they suddenly pop up again as the continued good influence in Tabler's life. It's his sister who encourages him to go to the police and confess. Those relationships and his association with morally good people are clearly very important to him, and it's obvious that he wants us to know that.
Tabler is seemingly proud of the fact that he has confessed to police about the crime. And in 2007, he went on trial for this. Now, we're going to hear the verdict in two parts because Tabler's case doesn't end simply with the sentence he received in his initial trial. There are continued complications about whether this man should live or die.
Letters from a Killer. The Verdict. Part 1. In April 2007, finding him guilty of capital murder, a Texas jury unanimously decided to sentence Richard Tabler to death.
But the irony is, despite the decision being made that he should die for his crimes, Tabler was not allowed to die on his own terms. In prison, after an incident where Tabler cut his own arms, he was seemingly deemed a suicide risk.
And what follows in the second part of the verdict is a strange situation in which both the prison authorities and the lawyers representing Tabler seem to go to great lengths to keep him alive, despite him having been sentenced to death, and despite his apparent wish to die.
The Verdict, Part 2. October 2008. Tabler was moved to 24-hour CCTV surveillance, a level of monitoring usually reserved for those on death watch as they await their executions. In 2009, Tabler's mandatory appeal, which he did not want, was denied. February 2010. After a May 2010 execution date was set, against Tabler's wishes, his lawyers attained a delay in the court order, known as a stay of execution. In a letter to the judge, Tabler wrote,
"This is not something I wanted, nor did I ask for."
Tabler stated that he had been significantly mistreated by guards and prison officials and added,
"If I'm going to be treated like an animal, you may as well execute me."
Richard Tabler continues to request the death penalty and remains on death watch to this day.
So, whilst waiting to die and apparently wanting to die but being prevented from carrying that out himself, Tabler then seems to have found new purpose in his life. In his letters to us, he reveals that on death row, he found faith as he frames himself with another characterization, this time as the committed and repentant Christian.
"Most of my time on death row is spent reading my Bible and sharing God's word with those around me and outside of these prison walls. I have asked Jesus Christ to forgive me these cowardly acts that I did back then and to give me a clean slate. And he has. I spend my days talking with God and praying for my mom, sister, niece, and my fiancée, Misty. I try not to think of my victims. No possible good can come from it. Though when I do pray for their families."
As ever, someone who's found God after having been convicted of murder is not a huge surprise for us as documentary makers working in this field. But it does seem that Tabler is very committed about it in the way that he writes to us in this letter.
Tabler asks us to go and read excerpts from the Bible in an effort to get us to understand him better. He's very keen to distinguish the transition he's been through from the seedy underworld criminal he was to the repentant good pastor he now is.
"Through God's grace, I have learned to be a good person who has love for others, instead of always thinking about myself. It's not about me. It's about you and how I am able to help you out."
The member of our team that he was writing to at the time that he wanted to help out was one of our researchers. And he writes with her a lot, trying to get her to look up specific Bible references and seemingly trying to convert her to Christianity and bring her into the light.
Do you believe in Jesus Christ? Are you saved? How do you deal with your day-to-day life out there? Are you married, single, or in between? LOL. I bet if you remain friends with me and I remain in this life, I can get you to turn from your agnostic ways. What do you think? Would you mind sending me a picture of yourself? This will allow me to place a face to the words and letters. If not, all good. I understand. So when you are not working, what do you enjoy doing? You want to hear something funny? I turn 38 years next Sunday, and I'm not liking this one bit. I'm starting to get old. LOL.
Tabla is trying to engineer a conversation and form a personal relationship with our researcher. This is something that we don't typically see. It's actually quite rare for someone to turn these letters around and to ask us questions. We don't actually want to become a part of the narrative. Tabla is also aware that the person he's writing to is female, especially when he asks her, are you married, single, or in between?
I know most people who are not locked up in prison think that those of us who are in prison are unable to do things for you out there. Thinking this way couldn't be more wrong. I'd like to offer you my sincere friendship and let you know it means a lot that you would reach out to me, wanting to interview me here on Death Row. Real friends only come around once in a lifetime. Also, you never know who you might be entertaining. Read in the Bible, Hebrews 13:2.
To what end is Tabla genuinely expecting our researcher to send him a photo? It makes me wonder whether he simply hasn't been able to distinguish between our contact on a professional level and that of a potential pen pal, or possibly even a romantic interest.
The Bible reference that Tabla quoted, Hebrews 13:2, goes like this.
Do not forget to show hospitality to strangers, for by so doing, some people have shown hospitality to angels without knowing.
Is Tabla suggesting that he's the angel in this scenario? Let me refer back to one of the first letters we had from him, which he signs off with the following quote, by no means do I claim to be a saint, but I am a disciple. It does seem that he's a man of extreme characterizations. One minute he's the gangster, the next the pious Christian figure, the angel and the executioner. He's the disciple and he's fatally flawed, but essentially he believes that he's good-hearted.
But is there an element of delusion in this belief that he is good-hearted? Can Tabla's assessment of himself actually be trusted? And I think to try and answer that, we need to look at what is another twist in the tale of Richard Tabla. Because despite Tabla's willingness to admit to us in his letters that he was responsible for the murder of Mo, somebody for whose death he was not tried or convicted of, something that Tabla never refers to in his letters to us is the fact that upon his arrest, he had also confessed to two other murders for which he was never tried.
After killing Rahmouni and Zayed, he had gone on to kill two dancers who worked at Amin's strip club. Two women who he believed were telling people about the murders of Rahmouni and Zayed and needed to be silenced.
Their names were Tiffany Lorraine Dotson, who was 18, and Amanda Benefield, who was only 16. Tabla had apparently lured them to a rural area with the promise of crack cocaine and then killed them with multiple gunshots to the head and body. And this is information that we found out in a statement from the police when we started looking further into Tabla's case. And Tabla, in all of his letters to us, doesn't even mention these two victims.
Did Tabla really think we'd never find this out, despite it being part of his record? These were two incredibly young women. They were children who had found themselves in bad circles. Neither of them would have been legally allowed to drink in the US, let alone work in a nightclub. So this does paint a further damning picture of Teasers as a place of illicit work and illegal activities.
And I'm left to wonder why it was he was apparently willing to incriminate himself in his letters to us regarding the murder of Mo, whereas he has quite clearly consciously chosen to leave out the details of these two young girls' deaths. Was it that he thought that Mo's murder would somehow make him look good to us? Was the girls' deaths would make him look bad?
But to set himself up throughout these letters as a protector of women, only for us to then find out he was responsible for the murder of two young girls, and then to retrospectively realise that he didn't even mention them? To me, that says a lot about the individual we're corresponding with and how skewed his own perception of himself and the perception he wants others to have of him actually is.
In this final episode of Letters from a Killer, we've discussed the letters of Richard Tabler. This is a man of inconsistencies and of contradictions. And this is apparent in the way that he frames himself to us and those around him.
Shit happens. I made my bed, and now I lay in it.
We've heard that he is a brutal murderer who was involved in various illicit activities that involved women, drugs, and guns.
But he's also presented himself as a savior of women.
Mo did not return to Killeen, and the girl was dropped somewhere else.
Somebody who felt the need to openly confess to his crimes.
I turned myself in to the authorities that night and confessed.
A man who decided to be both the underground gangster.
I placed the gun on his forehead and blew his brains out.
And the redemptive preacher.
I have asked Jesus Christ to forgive me these cowardly acts that I did back then and to give me a clean slate. And he has.
And this perfectly summarizes the highly complex nature of the inmates that we've written to across these 15 episodes as they attempt to exorcise the demons of their violent crimes in their letters from a killer.
Letters from a Killer has been an incredible team effort and would never have been possible without the hard work of those behind the scenes who've helped us correspond with these prisoners. Delphine Gilson, Maria Bazal, Jess Burgess and George Newman. The team would also like to thank Jake Chudnow and Sophie Paluk from Podimo for their commitment to and support of the show. And many thanks to the voice of our case files, Jane Perry, and the voice of our letters, Roberto David.
Thanks also to the team at Pod Solution, Colin Burgess, David Harper and Dominic Nangle, and with special thanks to the team at Transistor Films, Danny Tipping, Paula Cowles and Bernie Costello, and also to Natalka Snack and Marnie Sirota.
Letters from a Killer was hosted by Zoe Hines and Ned Parker and is a Podimo podcast by Transistor Films.